This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Well, now, I didn't make up this title. This was Dave's fault. when he first talked to me about coming to talk today, I was a bit intimidated, I must say, by this title because it's a rather large subject. But first of all, thank you very much for having me come along and talk today. It's actually a bit of a passion of mine, building links between the museum and schools, and I went through school at a time before extension history existed, and I must admit that's perhaps because why I didn't become a historian. I'm actually an anthropologist, so I should probably confess that up front, my take on making history and working in a museum actually doesn't come from a classic historical training background. I didn't do history at university. I trained as a social anthropologist and then moved into museums looking at issues of representation and so on. Although I had to learn quite a bit of Australian history along the way, I have to say. So, as Dave kind of set out just before, I understand that today is really very much about the question about what is history and how museums construct history and indeed why we construct history. And I think also I very much would like to discuss with you how we can think about ways in which your students can use museums and museum collections to develop their own understanding of the past and of historiographical practice. And I might say I have prepared a talk, but it is quite informal, and I would be more than happy to be interrupted frequently with any questions or questions for clarification. That would be more than welcome. So, I'm going to talk today really mostly about what I do as a curator here at the National Museum, but I want to try and draw some kind of generalities from that in terms of how there's a series of curatorial practices, if you like, tools and techniques and methods that I think could be of interest to your students and of interest to you in developing extension history courses. I want to talk about what I do as a curator, and then from that also talk a little bit about the kinds of history that I think museums are particularly good at creating and communicating. I think this is something I'd really like to discuss because I think it's not necessarily very well understood that museums, as Dave insisted by putting up my quote at the beginning of in his slide, is that I think museums create a very particular kind of history. It's not the kind of history that gets created in books or indeed in films or in, I don't know, compositions. It's a very particular kind of history that grows out of the fact that museums are centrally interested and defined by their collections. I should say that's not an uncontested view of museums, but it's certainly my view of museums. So as Dave mentioned, just a little bit about me. I'm currently the senior curator in charge of a museum program called Gallery Development. This was a program that got established in 2003 in the wake of what was called the Carroll Review of the museum, which was a government-sponsored review to, if you like, assess the museum's programs and activities, and particularly its exhibitions. And it was really at that moment, as Dave mentioned, right sort of, if you like, where the museum got embedded into the history wars and questions about whether the museum was appropriately representing the past. Out of that came a decision and indeed quite a large amount of funding to redevelop, among other things, three of our exhibition spaces. And I've been involved in working with a very large team of curators and other people across the museum over the last 6 or 7 years to develop those programs. And they include the Circa Theatre, which we redeveloped completely. They include the development of Australian Journeys, which is the gallery just outside this door, and which I'm going to talk a bit about today. And also an exhibition called Landmarks, which will replace our Nation Gallery. And if you walk through the museum today, you'll notice that a very large amount of our gallery space is currently closed off and completely empty. And that's because we've just deinstalled Nation in order to be able to start building Landmarks. And that's scheduled to open in April 2011. So you'll have to come back then to see it. So what does a curator do? This is actually a very interesting question to try and describe. I think a curator's role is fundamentally to try to understand how material culture, by which I mean objects or things, constitute evidence of other people's lives. And I have to say, you know, as I mentioned before, that I think there's actually very little difference in terms of trying to understand the lives of people from the past or indeed the lives of people in the present. And that's a little bit my kind of anthropological background. But I think one of the things I'm really interested in the museum is, in a sense, breaking down the sense of the idea of the museum as solely the preserve of history. I'm very much an advocate of William Faulkner's fabulous quote that The past is not dead, it's not even past. Because I think one of the things the museum is really deeply interested in, and which I'm certainly interested in, is finding ways in which we can connect people or help people connect what has happened in the past with what's actually happening in the present, with their own lives. I think history is not something that's kind of in the past that we need to learn lessons from. I think something that is very much alive and imminent and actually active in our lives today. So curators try to understand material culture as evidence of other people's lives, as a means to try to understand other people, what they looked like, what they did, how they made a living, what they hoped for in their lives, how they tried to construct their world, and why they made particular choices. And one way in which curators differ from other historians is therefore in focus in terms of how we interrogate the past, what elements we use to communicate the past. Most academic historians are trained very much in discipline of words, and they concentrate on words, still today, I think, although it's changing a little bit. If you go through university history, I think primarily you are encouraged to draw on things like archival accounts, manuscripts, now oral histories, and most of that work is actually promulgated in the form of books. There's also other kinds of historians. Obviously, filmmakers and photographers concentrate on creating images of the world and arranging them in meaningful sequences. But curators attend to objects. We look at objects as evidence of the past and try to arrange objects in meaningful ways called exhibitions. So I want to talk today a little bit, as I said, to unpack a kind of curatorial process and talk about how we interrogate objects as an evidence of the past. And I want to do that by just talking actually almost about a single object. We begin this process by looking very closely at the object in question. This might seem kind of like an obvious statement, but I actually think our looking skills as a society are rather poor. We see a lot of things. I mean, if you think about the amount of visual information that flows past us every day, it's absolutely enormous. But we actually spend very little time looking intently at something such as an object, and very little time asking what the look or, indeed, I think, you know, the feel or the smell or the taste of an object can tell us. And a key curatorial skill is the capacity to look intently and interrogatively at an object. So I'll just... here's an object that probably many of you will be already familiar with. If you've done any work in local museums or if you've done any work on the 19th century gold rushes, you probably know what this object is. But even if you know what it is, and sort of before labelling it, I just wanted you to, bit of interaction here, tell me what you notice about it just by looking at it.
Listen, can I just for a moment?
Yes, please do.
We are actually recording this session.
Oh, now you tell me.
I've got a microphone here, so if you'd like to ask that question, I'd like to answer it with the microphone. No pressure.
Or just yell. So, and what do you base that assumption on that's from the 1850s or the 1890s?
Bathurst. I just feel it's in good nick.
Yep.
The timber looks wonderfully preserved.
Yep. So you've noticed it's made of timber. That's a good, yep. Anything else? Anyone else is, like, what would you notice just looking at this object? Ah, another taker. Excellent.
Nothing too profound, but just the way it's constructed. It's constructed something that's practical and also something that, well, I think is quite aesthetically pleasing as well.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting because I think I actually think that those things that you've just mentioned are actually extremely profound in terms of understanding the significance of this object. The way in which it's what it's made from timber and obviously metal, the way it's constructed, is it constructed well? Is it constructed in an amateurish fashion? What is actually used to construct it? And how is it being used? How does it show evidence of wear? These are details that arise from us asking a whole series of questions about the object. And these are questions that, in terms of that process of looking, I think sometimes we're not very well trained to do in terms of our everyday lives. And these are questions, exactly as I said, what is it made of? How is it constructed? How is it being made, modified and used? How does it work? How could you imagine how it works? Is it actually photographed correctly or is it actually standing on its head? I don't know. And these questions and their answers, I think, lead to a further, more imaginative series of questions Who made this object and why? Who used it and how? Why did they choose to make and use it in this way? How would I use it? What skills would I need to make and use it? Do you use it with somebody else or on somebody else? What kind of tools or help or technologies would I need to make and use it? These are kind of the very kind of first questions with which a curator looks at an object. If we don't even perhaps know what it is, even if we do know what it is, we try and go back and try and understand these kind of fundamental things about how this object was made and worked. In order to answer these questions, curators consider individual objects in relation to many other kinds of evidence. As I've just mentioned, we analyse the characteristics of individual objects, often working with our conservation or other scientific staff to investigate things such as the age and type of wood used to construct a cradle such as this, to ask what does that information tell us about how diggers on the 19th century goldfields constructed cradles? Did they have to fell timber locally? Is it a local species? Or did they use timber from overseas? And if so, where did they get it from? What does that tell us in terms of how it's constructed or what kind of timber it's made from? What does that tell us about how much money hopeful miners had to invest in order to set themselves up on the fields? And what does that then tell us about who were the kind of people actually on the gold fields?
Sorry,
yes? Yeah, yeah. That's a very good guess, and you've totally spoilt my point later in the talk. yeah, I'll give it away. It's actually made of Douglas fir, which is a North American species, but to all intents and purposes, it seems as if this was wood that had probably been used as packing crates and had actually been brought to Australia as packing crates and then ended up on the goldfields and was constructed there, or possibly it was constructed actually down in Melbourne before being taken up to the goldfields. Yep, yeah, absolutely. And that tells us a lot, doesn't it, about what you actually do when you turned up in the goldfields and didn't have a cradle. What do? You go and scavenge a couple of old packing crates and actually build one. What does that mean about what you actually need to know in order to create a cradle? So we kind of analyse objects in detail, but we also consider objects in relation to each other. How, for example, does this particular cradle differ from other cradles of similar age but from different regions in Australia? How does it relate to cradles used in America or Argentina or Russia? How does it relate to other kinds of mining technology that developed on the goldfields? And what does this tell us about the transfer of technology and people between goldfields around the world? What does it tell us about mining technology, how mining technology was imported to Australia from elsewhere and adapted to cope with things such as the low water conditions prevailing in many parts of Australia? Gold washing cradle was absolutely dependent on having a good water supply because you needed to pour water through it in order to wash dirt. What did you do in somewhere where there wasn't much water? Also, of course, we consider objects in relation to other kinds of what you might call non-object evidence, to evidence such as the built and natural environments with which an object has been associated, to images of the object in use, to sounds of it being made or used, to things people have said or written about it, and also sometimes to the experience of using it. Sometimes actually working an object is a really important way of understanding its history. So through this work, this curatorial work of like bringing objects into relationship with each other and with other kinds of evidence, we begin to build up a picture of how people lived in the past. And I just want to draw your attention here to what I think is one of the distinctive ways in which curators interrogate history and consequently which we create historical narratives through collections and exhibitions. You'll notice from the process I've just sketched out that curators are very interested in how objects can inform us about how the world looked, smelt, felt, tasted, etc., and how people interacted with the world to shape and be shaped by it. In other words, curators are intensely interested in how objects can reveal the material form of the world and how people interacted with it. What is the stuff in which we are deeply enmeshed? And I think objects as a form of historical evidence lead us first and foremost to consider the material conditions of ours and others' lives and to ask how those material conditions interact with things such as social organisations, cultural frameworks, political ideologies and so on. And I think this is actually quite different from a lot of historiography that dominates written history. History is founded on and expressed in words that are often very good at describing what people have said or thought about their experiences. But, and I have to say with some very big exceptions, they're not necessarily very good at describing what it was like to live at a certain time and place. Historical fiction actually does better here with the kind of novelist eye for trying to describe what it was like to live at a time, but there's some pretty obvious problems with historical fiction because of the dramatic license that novelists take. I think it's also worth noting here that a history built on interrogating material culture is, I think, more particular than written histories. And by that I mean it focuses on specific histories of objects and people, the people that were involved with them, and asks what it was like to be at a particular time and place. I think what's interesting is one of the things we really discovered when we were developing Australian Journeys is we did a series of focus group discussions with people about what they, for example, if they saw this object, what they would actually like to know about in the gallery. And almost universally, the question that usually came back was people would say, we want to know what it was like to be in the 19th century goldfields. That was actually what they didn't necessarily want to know about the kind of broader structural changes that happened in Australian society, although that's something that usually, for example, historians are very keen to communicate. But what people were really interested in was actually knowing what was it like to actually spend your day getting up every morning and rocking this little thing back and forth while your mate carted water from the creek. So that's my point, is that kind of the idea about the kind of primary focus of history in the museum is, if you like, on what I call material history. So an experience about, a sense about what the material conditions of life were, and therefore what was it actually like to engage with those things at a particular time and place. Now, I think the question that arises for me is, so what? What's so great about understanding the material conditions of lives? Well, I think it's important because it helps us understand the lived experiences of others. To imagine, as I said, what it was like to spend all day shoveling dirt, carting water and rocking a cradle on the Victorian goldfields. To imagine what it was like to do this when you just arrived off a boat from Scotland, jumped off in Melbourne, bought a cradle, a pick and a shovel and carried it on your back to the Bendigo goldfields. And this is an understanding that comes to us from imagining how we might use objects and therefore how others might have experienced using them. And I think, just to sort of go on a bit of a polemic here, I actually think this capacity to engage people with others' lived experience is one of the most important roles of the museum, because understanding others' lived experience is the beginning of empathy, of people's capacity to imagine the lives of others, to recognise it as different from their own, and to begin to ask why different experiences have led to different attitudes, beliefs, hopes and actions. And I personally think that's one of the skills that constitutes the foundation of a successful plural society. Right, so the museum is essential to democracy. Let's see if I don't take anything else away today. That's what I want you to remember. So I want to just turn now, and I'm just thinking about, Dave, how long have I got till...
We've got the whole session until
10:15. Excellent, good. I was actually thinking that the last little bit we might actually transition out into the gallery, since I want to show you, talking about an exhibit that's out in the gallery, and since we're a fairly small group. Is that okay with you, Dave, if we do that? Cool. So I want to turn now, I've talked a little bit about how we, for example, would go about interrogating and understanding this particular object as historical evidence and why we would do that. And I want to talk a little bit now about how we then take the next step and say, how do we actually take that and how do we then try and engage our visitors with that understanding of the past and of others? So as I think as you came in, you may have actually caught a quick glimpse of Australian Journeys in which this object currently resides. And I think, Dave, you're going to talk a little bit, maybe do some exercises around AJs later in the morning, perhaps, sorry, not to preempt your exciting program. So Australian Journeys is a gallery that we opened just over a year ago now. It explores how Australia is interconnected with the world. It traces the journeys of many different kinds of people to and from Australia and investigates the connections these journeys have created between places here in Australia and places overseas. If you like, the kind of shorthand for that is that it creates a transnational history of Australia. So how did we go about developing this gallery? That's obviously a pretty enormous topic. We began by drawing on the existing historical scholarship to identify the major flows or trajectories and movements of people to and from the Australian continent. And once we had done that, we then began identifying collections that related to each of these trajectories or themes, if you like, and to ask how those collections illuminated this transnational history. I'm going to talk about one exhibit in particular which jumps off from this cradle. Of course, the 19th century gold rushes were, one of the key trajectories in this transnational history. It's an amazing period in Australia's history. A lot of people get a bit bored with it, I think. But I think when you think about the fact that in 20 years the population of the Australian colonies trebled, that's an amazing sense about a kind of period of social change. And obviously, as I mentioned, the gold washing cradle here was one of the key objects that we identified in our own collections as relating to the gold rushes. Now, a lot of people were a bit surprised when we kind of went into raptures over the gold cradle, because it's an object that the museum has held in its collection for a long time and never really made much of a fuss about. That's because in many ways this is an object that's incredibly similar to thousands of other gold washing, hundreds of other gold washing cradles from the same period that are held throughout Australian museums. I think, you know, you said that you probably had seen one at Golgong local museum. And I think, you know, they really do occur quite frequently through, for example, regional museum collections and indeed the larger institutions. And it's like many of those objects, we don't actually know necessarily a lot about this particular object. We don't know who made it. We don't know who used it. We know that it was collected near Ballarat, Victoria, and we've kind of assumed that it was used on the Victorian goldfields. But in some ways, the immediate story that we know about it isn't necessarily a very inspiring one. It's not associated necessarily or immediately with some incredible figure, some incredible individual in Australian history, although I'll contest that in a minute. Yep.
From that time.
Yep. Well, we certainly can prove the period from details, for example, of the metal pieces that were used. So we know they're 19th century handmade nails, or handmade nails exactly the same as all the other handmade nails that we've ever seen from the 19th century. So we assume they're 19th century. Similarly, the wear on the timber and the kind of process through which the metal has gone through is consistent with other material that would have gone through that period. When we purchased it, the vendor that we bought it from had fairly good evidence that it had been used in the Ballarat region in terms of where he had actually got it from and where it had. We were able to trace it back a fair way in terms of its location. But it's a very good question, because we spent a lot of time trying to figure out whether something is actually what it purports to be. Why were we interested in making an exhibit about this object? As we began investigating, I think using the questions and the kind of process that I just described before, I think it became much more interesting and illuminating. As we just talked about, an analysis of its materials revealed that it was a 19th century cradle with handmade nails and metal corners, and as I mentioned before, the wood of Douglas fir, which we're pretty sure came from packing crates. It is a functional cradle, but it's actually not terribly well made. When you look at the kind of carpentry and joinery that is made in it, it's rather, you know, the corners are rather uncomfortably set together and so on. And this suggests that it was actually constructed not by, say, an expert craftsman or by someone who was producing a lot of cradles, but rather by someone who turned up on the goldfields and possibly learned from other miners how to construct it, or purchased it from someone who was knocking them together in a tent somewhere. However, the very ubiquity of this cradle across the Australian goldfields, which is suggested by their widespread presence in museum collections, suggests that, you know, it was a highly democratic technology, the cradle, that new immigrants or people arriving on the fields could easily access the knowledge about how to build a cradle, and you could knock one together from not very glamorous materials. And this meant that people who had, say, energy and determination, perhaps like vain hope or nothing else to go to, but not necessarily with very much capital or experience, could actually become miners. And I think it's really possible, when you think about that, the fact that anybody could almost turn up and actually get a cradle, is to begin to imagine what it felt like to kind of turn up on the fields, to put together your cradle, really hopeful you might find a lucky find, and then I think probably go through a process for most miners of realising that alluvial mining with cradles meant days and days of unremitting, backbreaking labour, usually with very little reward. So as we researched the relationship of this cradle to other cradles, we really began to discover how this technology, this very simple technology, had travelled across the world. The cradle as a form seems to have been, we don't really know where it developed originally, but it seems to have been developed either in Borneo or in the Ural Mountains in Russia or in Africa. Just narrow it down. We don't really know for sure, but it certainly seems to have made its way to Australia via the California goldfields, and in particular through the actions of one man, who is the first man recorded to actually have used a cradle in Australia. And that's a guy called Edward Hammond Hargraves, who is this sort of sort of aspiring Australian jack of all trades, who in 1849 like chucked in his work in Australia and headed off to the California gold rushes. And there he learnt two essential skills. One was to recognise gold-bearing country, and the other was how to build and operate a gold-washing cradle. So in 1851, he came back to New South Wales, not having made very much money in California, and decided that he wasn't going to make his money by actually getting gold. He was going to claim the £10,000 that the New South Wales government was offering as a reward for finding payable gold in the colony, partly because so many of Australians were actually leaving to go to California, and the colonial government thought, oh dear, we actually need some people back. So Hargraves travelled to Bathurst, where he'd worked in the 1830s, and which he now recognised in the 1850s as looking like the gold-bearing country in California. And sure enough, when he talked to local farmers, they reported seeing gold specks in various creeks. Hargraves teamed up with them and importantly then taught them how to make a gold-washing cradle, which he had learned in California, and which could then be used to work through enough wash dirt to establish whether those specks represented a payable find or just, you know, a little kind of gathering of specks. And that was the beginning of the gold rushes in Australia. I have to say Hargraves wanted to claim the £10,000, even though the local farmers were extremely angry about it and campaigned for years to actually get some of the money back. So in Australian journeys, so we've got this kind of thing where we've got like a cradle that is itself not that specific, that is linked to a kind of technology that's ubiquitous in many kind of gold fields across the world, but it is very closely linked in terms of its technological form rather than in terms of a specific history to this individual, Hargraves. So in Australian journeys, we wanted to invite visitors to consider the cradle in this number of ways, as a technology that had travelled across to Australia, as an integral player in the discovery that precipitated the 19th century gold rushes, and one of the key technologies enabling and defining life on the fields for thousands of people. And we also wanted to draw out the connections between the mundane commonality of the cradle and Hargraves' extraordinary story and the incredible significance for Australia's economy and society of the gold rushes. So how could we draw together a number of elements in the gallery space to explore these overlapping interpretations? And I think I should also just point out, one of the real philosophies we took in Australian journeys was not to say one of these interpretations or one of these stories is more important than the other. We really wanted to, rather than be definitive about what it is that visitors should take away from the exhibit, we wanted to, if you like, open up a whole series of different kinds of overlapping interpretations and stories, each of which could be of interest and of meaning to the visitors, depending on the kind of questions they brought with them. So, for example, some people come to the exhibit and they're fantastically interested in mining technology. Some people are interested in how you build a cradle because they're still used, as prospectors still use them today. Other people were incredibly interested in the Hargraves story, and we wanted to create an exhibit with enough overlapping layers that actually people would be able to bring what they were interested about to it. Sorry, that's a fantastic sentence, isn't it? Bring to it what they were interested in. So, first of all, we chose to display the cradle, and this is where I'm just actually wondering if we might transform to the gallery. Would that be okay? I don't think it's too busy out there, and I thought that might actually be an experimental day, because I've only got this appalling... Oh, sorry, there's a picture of corn. I've only got this a terrible image, and I think we should actually just go and stand in front of the actual exhibit. Would that be all right? Is that everybody? Didn't lose anybody in the corrals? It's kind of like the seventh inning stretch, isn't it? Right. Hopefully now you can actually interpret this photograph a little bit better. And I just want to talk through a few of those kind of display features and why we chose to take that approach. As we talked about, that we chose to display the cradle not in a naturalistic mode, if you like, as it would have been used, but rather in this kind of separated form where different parts of the cradle are actually separated out from each other. And we wanted to do that because we really wanted to get visitors to begin to think about how the cradle was constituted as a form of technology, and to help them, where we talked in the interpretive text about how the cradle was used, to understand what those different parts were. And that's referring back, if you like, to what we were talking about earlier about the way in which the transferred nature of the cradle technology and what people on the goldfields might actually have had to know about in order to build a cradle. And of course, you know, as you saw, we used a series of images and sound to communicate the incredible spread of the cradles. This fantastic image, which I personally love, appears in the flip book in the exhibit. As you can see, sort of in the foreground there, you've got a couple of people working cradles, and as your eye travels backwards, you realise about every few metres is another group of people mining away, trying to strike it lucky. And as you saw, we used a sound installation, as I described, to really try and again give a sense in a kind of sensorial way, rather than in a written way or a textual way, but in a sensorial way to give people a sense about what the goldfields might actually have been like. Now, Australian Journeys is a gallery that focuses quite strongly on individual stories and that traces the particular trajectories of objects and the specific people in whose lives they participated. And as I mentioned in the gallery, in Australian Journeys, what we try to do is interweave in quite a kind of open way, if you like, the interpretation of the Ballarat crater with that of Hargraves. And we try to thread through this idea about the interweaving between people and objects, even in terms of the kind of way in which we wrote the text in the exhibit. This is what we called the kind of introductory story panel for the exhibition. And you'll notice a few things about it. The title, for example, we very much tried to direct people to what we called the key object in the exhibit, which in this case was, of course, the cradle. We used a quote from Edward Hargraves he had this fabulous turn of phrase. It was really great. And then as you read through, you'll notice that we do tell the story, if you like, about Hargraves' journey from Australia to California, back to Australia, and particularly the ways in which that actually connected two places in the world. On the top there, you've got California, the California goldfields where Hargraves worked and where he learnt to recognise gold-bearing country, and then the Ophir diggings down below, which was where he recognised gold-bearing country in Australia and started the gold rushes. And we try right at the end of the story panel to really suggest the way in which Hargraves' story is interwoven with the story of that particular cradle. Sorry, I just had to put this in because I think this was Hargraves when this is allegedly what he said in his book he wrote. This is what he said when he discovered gold. And believe me, when we read this, we thought, oh, if only his horse had been stuffed and put in the British Museum, we could borrow it for the exhibition. But no such luck, I'm afraid. I think the old horse didn't make it to the museum.
So this is the real reason.
It's true. Yeah, David knows I really like horses. So in many ways, as I just said, in Australian Journeys, we try to tell particular stories and to engage visitors with the specific histories of objects and individuals. This is a well-developed and very successful museum technique, and it's been used throughout this museum, particularly, for example, in the Eternity Gallery downstairs, and is, you know, used widely in other museums as well. And the reason that is because visitors seem to find it very comfortable and accessible to connect first with individual stories and experiences to try to understand, as I said, what it was like for somebody else. But I think this doesn't mean that those individual stories can't lead into broader considerations of how people were enmeshed in wider historical structures and processes. And we try very hard to address this in Australian Journeys. For example, the other two sides of the gold exhibit that you just saw, one relates to Chinese experience on the goldfields, which was, of course, very different from European experience on the goldfields, and the other relates to a chap called Alexander Mussen, who came to the goldfields to sort of rescue his life. He was a sort of tearaway 24-year-old, and his dad packed him off from Montreal in Canada to the goldfields to improve himself, and he promptly got shot by a bushranger trying to protect a friend's store. It wasn't a happy story at all. It's a very sad story. So we wanted to counter, if you like, kind of put on the other side to the Hargrave story and start to draw out some of the broader kind of complications around the gold rushes in Australia. And elsewhere we directly, you know, address how many people came to Australia and so on. So I think what I wanted to say there is that in Australian Journeys we do focus on the particular stories and particular objects and their particular histories. And as I said, that's a well-developed museum technique. And I think the point I want to make here is to say that this is a very particular kind of museum historiography. It is developed in other places, for example, in biography, in written biography. But in the museum, because of the way we can focus on materiality and on lived experiences, I think it takes on a very strong trajectory in the museum and can be a very powerful form of historiography for the museum. And I would argue, I think it's actually probably the kind of historiography that the museum is best at as a form of history making. We can have a big discussion about that afterwards if you like. So just to conclude, I chose to talk through the Australian Genius Gold Rushes exhibit today. I didn't mean to choose one that was actually featured in the Australian history curriculum, but somehow I got sidetracked onto the Gold Cradle, so never mind about that. But one of the reasons I wanted to do the Gold Cradle is because it's an exhibit built, as I said, around an object that occurs commonly in many museums around Australia. And there are thousands of objects like this, christening gowns, Aboriginal stone tools, books of watercolour drawings, agricultural equipment that are everywhere. And these are objects which I think could constitute for your students a tremendous resource, because each of them represents, in the way that I've talked about the cradle and the exhibit, a little portal through which they can interrogate and begin to understand the experience of others and certainly the experience of others in the past. And I've tried this morning to map out a few of the tools through which I as a curator undertake this work, both in terms of analysing collection objects as historical evidence and in terms of how students can begin to look at museum displays as forms of historiography. One of the things I would really love to see develop is a series of projects through which students access either their local collections or collections held in larger cultural institutions, because this would be a process through which students could actually meaningfully contribute to the documentation and knowledge about those collections, as well as developing their own understanding of the past. And to go back to what was said earlier, how else are we going to train the next generation of curators when I want to retire? That's it. So please, any questions would be more than welcome about anything. Well, not my personal life, but okay. Well, first of all, I should say they're debated a lot. And I think certainly the experience of working at the National Museum is that the questions about what gets displayed are extremely examined, I think. And that's a process that occurs both through, it involves a lot of people, I guess, to talk about the process a little bit. Obviously, there's usually a team. So, for example, in developing Australian Journeys, there's a team of curators who work on that project through time. And they will make a series of decisions along the way about which themes should get addressed in terms of what the kind of representative breadth and the kind of historical argument of the gallery should be. That's then very much iterated against what collections are available or what collections seem to speak powerfully. And there is certainly an element in there about how individual curators respond to individual collections. And that's not necessarily, I think, a very objective process. I know Kat and Rowan might like to contribute here. But very much a process through which certain objects and certain collections seem to communicate evocatively about somebody else's experiences. And that can be a very powerful kind of moment in exhibition development. And personally, I think often leads to the best kinds of exhibitions is when you kind of have a collection that feels very, evocative for the curators themselves, and they're there for it. That's something they really want to communicate to visitors. But there is then a long process of deciding which of the very many possible stories that arise out of the collections should actually make it through to the gallery. So Australian Journeys has about, 42 exhibits in it. Well, we started out with quite well-developed stories for about three times that number. And we then went through a very long process about judging which of those should go forward, both on the kind of strength of the content, but also very much on the question about this was a permanent gallery for the museum, so it had to sustain a certain kind of representational breadth. For example, we felt strongly that we needed a story about 19th century journeys of Indigenous Australians. Like, this is extremely difficult to tell because the surviving material culture around those journeys is extremely rare. We actually really only identified three collections across the whole of the world so far that we could actually use. One we couldn't borrow, another one we could only put on display for a couple of months because it was so fragile, and so we were left with kind of not much choice about if we wanted to put that in, but we felt it was very important that we put that in, so we included a story about New Norcia and the New Norcia Mission in Western Australia. So that's the process, and then that process about working through which stories, if you like, go forward and how they will be told is a process that involves curatorial staff, involves staff from across the museum. Dave was involved in some of those discussions, public programs, with historians and other academics outside the museum, and very much a kind of judgment balancing up what do we need to do in terms of telling a coherent Australian history that we think touches on all the important moments that will create a good exhibition, because not all subjects create a good exhibition. I've yet to know how to kind of put together a good exhibition about the history of income tax. And also, what do we actually think or what do we know that visitors will be interested in? They're all things that come together in a way. I think it was interesting when we opened the gallery. Of course, you know, we did quite a bit of media, and the question that I got asked most of all was like, you know, well, essentially, to paraphrase it, the question was like, you know, did you get a lot of political interference in developing the gallery? Did the government tell you what you should or shouldn't include? And I have to say, the answer to that was no. I actually felt very little pressure about what to include or not to include in the gallery. The main answer I get was that the biggest message we get from our visitors is that they want to hear all sides of the story. They want to kind of know the different varieties of kind of trajectories in Australian history. What they least want is a kind of highly edited and controlled version of Australian history. Sorry, does that answer your question at all? Sorry, no, please go ahead.
It has changed over time.
Over time, yes. No, that's certainly true. And I think that's part of, you remember I kind of, you know, said how much I love that William Faulkner quote, you know, that there is no such thing as history, really. It's all about the present. And very much so, and I guess perhaps this is part of my, you know, kind of background as an anthropologist rather than a historian, I really see the museum is about things that have happened in the past. But in terms of its form and what it's interested in addressing, it's really about intervening and participating in the national conversation in Australia about what our society is about and what it should be like and what are the possibilities about how it could be. That's what actually I see as the purpose of the museum. And I think that's the purpose of history generally. So yes, it has changed. I think obviously the interest about what people are interested in now, what we're interested in talking about, the way in which we're interested in representing Australian society. I'm very interested in representing Australian society as a, you know, a diverse and plural one that actually, in which national boundaries don't necessarily mean that much to lots of people. If you go into Australian Journeys, I think what really comes out is that for lots of people, being Australian, that's a very kind of complicated topic. You know, many people feel as Australian as they feel, you know, Latvian or Vietnamese or Greek or, you know, there are very strong connections. And I was very interested in creating a gallery that took that on board and very strongly represented that because I felt that was an important contribution to broader Australian public culture. And, yeah, in the early 19th century, I don't think people would have been interested in that way. I think what's interesting, though, particularly about this gallery, is that in many ways it is actually quite like, in terms of the object display, it's actually quite like an earlier 20th century display because we tried to, if you like, bring the focus back to objects. It was a big move through museology in the 80s, sort of 70s, 80s and 90s to very heavily interpret objects and very kind of contextualise them with, for example, exhibition text and images and to really kind of think about objects as illustrations of broader themes in Australian history. And in this gallery, we actually very purposefully went across against that trajectory and said, no, we think the museum is about objects and we don't really mind if the possibilities for interpretation around objects are quite open. We actually like that. We think visitors are kind of smart enough to come and make sense of things. And that's why, for example, we took all the exhibition text out of kind of very close affinity with the objects.
I think one of the main changes has been seeing museums no longer as a depository for absolutely everything.
Yep.
And having a more analytical or interpretive sort of approach and being selective about what's on display, what doesn't get displayed, and you now go through that whole process of deciding what goes on instead of just dumping how many local museums do you go into. And, you know, there's somebody's final web spider collection and all this bizarre stuff that I'm sure it tells a story, but because it's all thrown in there, you can't actually interpret what that is.
Yeah, and I think that's sort of going back to the point I was talking about at the end of the talk about, in essence, in my mind, anything is interesting. It's a question about how much kind of capacity there is for doing the work of interpretation around it. And it's kind of a...
How much of your collection is what's on display?
It's about 5% is on display.
Yeah.
And I... You know, our previous director hated that, but I'm actually okay with that, to tell you the truth. I mean, there's kind of big resource questions about it. But I think what we constantly discover as curators is that objects become of interest at different points in their lives. So an object that at one point, you know, is not very much of interest to anybody, suddenly, like, you know, 20 years down the track, becomes of intense interest. And I often go through collection files where we've actually rejected offers, and I'm like, you know, beating my head against the thing, like, oh, if only we'd collected that. You know, at one point I was developing an exhibition about this, you know, suburban backyard, and I discovered that the museum at some point had turned down a collection which was offered, which was a complete collection of Yeats seed packets and seed catalogues, which would have been a fantastic kind of resource to illustrate the changing kind of use of the garden, the kind of changing ideas about the garden. But 20 years ago when it had been offered, nobody thought that was actually very interesting. So I think there's kind of a real balance. I agree. It's certainly, you know, kind of having just a whole bunch of stuff is in some ways not very useful or provocative, but also sometimes just having a whole bunch of stuff is a wonderful resource for you know, people to come, because suddenly funnel-web spiders are like, you know, there's like a rash of funnel-web spiders, and suddenly, you know, funnel-web spiders are the most important thing in the planet. It's a very hard thing about collection management and collection development.
Possibly partly to do, too, with democratisation of our history, that people want to be more involved and want to access collections, want to access the sort of thing more. They feel that it's... Well, you can say, well, it's our money.
Yeah, yeah.
We're the taxpayers. We should be accessing it.
Yep,
and,
yeah. And I think that's a great thing. And I think that's sort of at the end, I sort of mentioned that in a way, something I would love to see develop, say, for example, with higher level high school students, is a greater relationship between them and particularly local museums, who often local museums actually are completely suffering under the fact that they don't have the resources to do the documentation around, like to kind of figure out what's in their collection and what's interesting about it. And I could totally imagine a scenario in which a student, for example, goes along and thinks, God, that, you know, funnel web spider in a jar is pretty, you know, bizarre. I kind of like spiders. And, you know, goes off and does a whole project looking at, you know, what is this? You know, why is there a funnel web spider in a jar in the museum? Where did it come from? Who in the community could I talk to about this object? Or, you know, can I contact scientists at the Australian Museum to talk about, you know, funnel web spiders, and develop a whole, you know, that kind of very curatorial process about saying, what are all the fields of knowledge I can draw on in order to understand what this object is, and then to be able to write that up. And that would then become a really important resource for the museum as well.
It was interesting you made that reference to, in some ways, you've gone back to the object and the way things may have been done in the early 20th century in museums. That it appeared to me, the obsession with interactivity that appeared to be the go perhaps 15, 20 years ago, maybe has ended recently. Is that still an element that you've got to bring into it when you choose things? There's got to be this interactive component, supposedly, to make it fun?
Yeah.
Going back to the lady here saying, you know, how it's changed over time, it seems to me that there's been this obsession by, you know, the popular sort of press and some of the forces in education that it's all got to be seen to be fun and interactive. Has that sort of, for me, a pejorative word, interactivity, been a component?
Look, it's certainly been a very live discussion at this museum and over sort of, you know, 10 years, but and also more recently. You're absolutely right. During the really kind of the early 90s, there was, as you say, a great drive to make museums interactive. And I think that was coming out of a number of trajectories, some good, some not so great, I think. One of them was, I think, a recognition of different learning styles, you know, and that some people didn't actually do very well, like reading lots of text panels. which is, you know, often seen as the way in which museums communicate, although I would dispute that, and that we needed to provide a more diverse range of experiences for people, and that led to kind of push to what's often called interactivity. The other one, which I think was less helpful, was a kind of argument that the museum must, you know, teach people things. People must learn things when they go to the museum. And perversely, like, that was both seen like, well, people must have more fun at the museum because then they'll actually come, but also they must be more active in the museum. Just standing and looking at something was not actually seen as doing anything. You know, that's just seen as doing, as kind of standing around being bored, which I would strongly contest. I think particularly in museums, many visitors welcome museums as places where they can actually come and look, contemplate things, I think, and learn at their own, you know, read and understand things at their own pace. So I think that's those trajectories are still very strong in museums generally, and certainly at this museum. I think over the last little while, and certainly I've, you know, argued this, that I think we need to respect that idea that looking at something, that that kind of intense looking is itself a form of interactivity, if you like. Something is going on in people's heads, even if it's not something that you can then necessarily easily measure by an exit survey when they leave the museum. But also that there are ways to introduce what we might call interactivity in the museum that are extremely tied to that. So one of the things, if you go through and look at Australian Journeys, is we introduced a lot of what we called sensory stations, which are actually very simple forms of interactivity. They are, for example, if you go just around the corner from the gold washing cradle, there's an exhibit about Chinese brickmaking in Bendigo. And we actually reproduced or acquired some of the original bricks from that 19th century bricks because we had some on display. But we also realised one of the really significant ways in which people will connect with that is through touch. And so we just included some bricks because, and what you see is people standing there and they'll be looking at the bricks and their hand will be like moving over those bricks. That's a form of interaction that I think is actually, you know, peaceful, but also extremely important because it activates another sense in terms of how people interact.
The lighting is really theatrical.
Yep.
And I know that you have to be aware of the conservation of the objects, and they can't have heavy lights on them. But the mood of the gallery and the illumination. Have you been to Parry Ruins in Ross?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't seen that.
Same. Back to archaeological dig in rocks up in Sydney, and they've just got it really, really simply presented. There's just a simple platform, just a metal platform where you walk out down into the cellar, and they've got just these elements. There's nothing there, but there's everything there. It's just so beautifully lit that it's a theatrical experience going into it.
Yep.
And it makes you stop and walk, and the artifacts that are being excavated are on display in a few cases, just really simply, just again laid out, lit, a little bit of information, and it's so much information with just whatever remnants are there, and that's part of the story too, that all this stuff has been ruined, it has been destroyed, we are lucky to have these fragments.
Yep.
And it's really powerful, just space.
Yeah.
Just and it's fragments of human experience.
Yeah. It's very, sorry, Dave, I'm conscious that probably we're running out of time, but I think it's a really interesting question for me to ask, and Dave and I have talked about this quite often, is what is it that visitors are actually getting from that experience? I personally would say they're getting something very profound and something that continues to work through their imagination and their sense of the world for a long time, but I don't think it's something that people can, for example, can very necessarily easily put into words. It's not actually, I think, necessarily even a kind of linguistic kind of thing. It's a sense about how what the character of the material world is, and that's a kind of embodied experience. Sorry, but that's a whole other kind of discussion. Yes?
Going back to that decision-making from, you know, the curators about what will actually be shown, being such a sort of a sceptical person, I was wondering if there's surveillance cameras there actually monitoring how the public apparently respond to the different exhibits, because, of course, it could go down a path, or maybe in the past, where you think, no, that object is sort of, no one appears to be sort of reacting, responding, interacting with that. So that object can perhaps be consigned to the dustbin of history. Are there surveillance cameras monitoring how people respond to these things, and perhaps is that part of the process?
Yeah. That's right. Actually, we would love surveillance cameras so we could see what visitors how visitors responded to the galleries, but we're not allowed to do that. We actually talked a long time about it because I would actually love to see what it is that visitors are interested in. So what we tend to do is actually talk a lot to the visitor services hosts who actually have this wonderful, get to spend so much time on the floor, have this wonderful experience about how people, you know, respond to things. And I have to say that what people choose to focus on in exhibits is often completely amazing. One of the hosts told me a story the other day about how she was up there with a group of 14, 15-year-old boys from Western Sydney. So kids who had never been to a museum before, they weren't really kind of into the whole history thing at all. And she said that we've got an exhibit in there which talks about a table which was made in the 18th century from the first wood sent back from New South Wales to England to establish whether there was kind of viable timber industry here. And we've teamed it with a whole series of the tools that would have been used to make that table, most of which are now pretty much obsolete. And this host told me this wonderful story about, she said there was this one boy who kind of wandered through totally bored the whole time, totally not paying attention, and then he suddenly latched onto this exhibit and was completely fascinated by it. And she said, you know, what do you find interesting about it? And he said, I really love carpentry. And, we've got a tool like that, but I've never seen that tool before. And, look, you know, and he was, reading about how they got used. And for me, that was, a fantastic experience. Because I'm actually not too worried if he doesn't do the bigger thing about, understanding the table and the first fleet and all that kind of stuff. What I'm really chuffed about is he's found a way to get into a sense about the way which his passion has developed over time and in which his craft depends on all this work that has actually, you know, what people have done before and how it's changed over time. And that for me is about him connecting to a much broader social environment and so on. And the fact that I would never have probably anticipated that, you know, if someone told me about that visit, I would never have anticipated that that's what he would have actually said, that's what I absolutely, you know, love. But there you go. You put it out there and people do what they want with it. Well, there you go. Yeah. Yeah, and that's what I think, and that's why I'm totally relaxed about, you know, we do create a kind of a whole historical narrative, but you know what? And I think it's important to do that because some people are looking for that, but a lot of visitors actually, they're not really that interested in that. They're actually interested in finding what it is in a really direct way that connects very strongly with their experience. And our job is then to say, ornithology happened in 1910 in Australia and it's still going on about, you know, the way to society and so on. Sorry, there was one up the back there. Yeah.
It's interesting when you're creating an exhibit, whether you have a target audience in mind when you make it.
Yeah, this is actually a very complex question for the National Museum because we are, you know, basically our target audience is everybody. but we have identified a series of audiences. Traditionally, and this is true for this museum as well, most of the visitors who come to the museum are either families with primary school age children or relatively well-educated adults or indeed school students here on school visits. Yeah, forced visitors. Yes, we love them. So that is, if you like, the kind of audience with which we primarily keep in our heads as we're developing stuff. But maybe it's just my opinion, I also recognise that, for example, we get lots of people with very little children come through, 4 and 5 year olds. How do you engage a 4 and 5 year old with history? I don't know. I think I've noticed that lots of them love the Little Red Riding Hood quilt. If you go in there, there's a big quilt. You know, we created an animation of the story, and if you go through there, there's often a couple of 4-year-olds sitting there avidly watching the animation related to that object and connecting with it that way. You know, how do you capture young 20 to 25 year olds? That is a market that the museum has yet to attract in any meaningful numbers. So we kind of do this dual thing. We go, okay, so we've got a kind of, we kind of know primarily who our visitors will be, which is driven, I think, by historical patterns of museum visiting, about who comes as tourists to Canberra, a lot of other kinds of things. But we also are very interested in trying to extend those audiences. And we
20-year-olds will be back in 10 years and they've got their kids.
Yeah, that's right. We just let him go for the while. But we also try and do public programs does a great job about actually looking at trying to target very particular audiences who have been underrepresented in the museum and trying to address those as well. I mean, for example, you know, people with visual disabilities or auditory disabilities or learning disabilities. These are all audiences that we're constantly trying to think about. How do we both make the museum accessible for them and also find ways to really engage them with the exhibits?
Yeah.
We do have a. We've got Facebook. I don't know if we've got to Twitter yet. I think we've got to Twitter. Have we? We've got Twitter. Yeah. I'm really interested in thinking about how we can use, you know, like portable, you know, wireless technology in the museum as a way to, you know, do more fun stuff. So, you guys are doing that. Yeah. 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 I went to the Japan. Sorry, I'll tell one more story. I went to a museum in Japan a little while ago, which had tried that. And it was quite hilarious because they hadn't really, you know, you had this thing and like you went through and as it, like, you entered various wireless zones, it would let off this little beep and like then it would like tell you something about the exhibit. Anyway, I lasted about like 15 minutes because there were so many like zones in the museum. Like every few seconds, if you stood here, like you'd hear one, and literally if you like changed your angle like this, like you'd enter another zone and there'd be like another beep and suddenly you'd be jumping out of like Starfish into like, you know, I don't know, like Meiji Japan or something. Like, it's completely insane. Anyway.
We've had a question about, you know, how galleries change over time. In terms of actually selecting a big theme like Australian Journeys or the new Landmarks Gallery, which is going to be in a big gallery about 19th, 20th century Australian history, how does the museum make that kind of decision? How does it make that decision about, oh, we want to do something about transnational histories?
Yep.
As opposed to the actual specific decisions about
what goes in it? Yeah, yeah. Yeah, it's a very mystical process, which I don't know I can really let you in on. But look, Dave, I think the way how I would answer that is to say that's really about the way in which you know, people within the museum are part of a broader public cultural discussion and a broader scholarly discussion about what's the ways in which history is developing and what the way in which Australian society is developing. So I think, I mean, I actually think the decision, which I have to say was made before I came back to the museum after a break away, to do a gallery about transnational history, that was really a decision that picked up on a series of kind of emerging fields of scholarship within Australian history. And I know both the then general manager and myself had like a lot of discussions early on in the stage with, say, kind of leading historians in the field about what were the kind of emerging fields of Australian history. So that was certainly one trajectory. But I think the other one was very much, it was really coming out of a series of discussions about what would be a really interesting and innovative way in which the museum could participate in discussions about Australian culture and identity. And I think, you know, we were at that stage, so coming out, and I think, you know, in a sense, in response to the Carroll Review, a period in Australian culture which was very obsessed and interested with defining Australian identity, and that had led to things like the history wars, and that actually hadn't necessarily been an incredibly productive way for Australians to think about themselves. And so we were very interested in trying to think of a kind of gallery theme that would, if you like, step aside from those debates about, you know, what does it mean to be Australian? What is it, you know, if you're either Australian or you're not, you know, you're either black armband or you're white bread, those kinds of questions. And I think to say identity as a kind of topic is not necessarily a very productive focus for the museum because of the way in which the museum is built around collections, and collections naturally lead us to a kind of material history, a materialistic understanding of history. And the kind of material history is quite a long way from identity. And I think that's where the idea that why don't we do a gallery that actually says, let's not look parochially at what it means to be Australian. Let's actually kind of look expansively and say, well, Australia is and has been always connected to the world in a lot of complex ways. And wouldn't it be interesting to actually explore that, to say, you know, for a long time the museum's, you know, mission statement was, you know, what does it mean to be Australian, I think was how it was put. And I think we felt very strongly at the beginning that that was actually a kind of parochial, I think would be the word, a quite kind of limited vision for the museum, and that the museum could be, and indeed Australia, could be much more self-confident about saying, you know, actually being Australian is like lots and lots of different things, including this kind of incredibly productive and engaging expansion with the world, and how that's created a very plural society, I think.
National maturity, that do we constantly need to obsess about what it means to be Australian? No, we're a bit more grown up now.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And I think, actually, it's been very interesting, some of the discussion around Australian journeys since the gallery opened, is our view was to, in the gallery, was to, if you like, not make a fuss about the fact that Australia is a really diverse plural society, just to kind of accept it as a given, just assume that, and say what we're actually interested in is, like, drawing out some of the kind of different trajectories and complexities of that plurality and the ways in which it's developed in a global context, rather than doing, for example, what migration galleries have often done, which is to say, you know, there were Indigenous people, you know, then there was this, then there was the White Australia policy, and that was terrible, and then there was, you know, this kind of stage for history of policies about how to govern diversity. We just said, actually, we think Australia's a diverse thing. We think the evidence shows that it's always been a diverse thing. Yes, those have been debates, and if you look in the gallery and kind of the detailed content, those debates were all in there. But we said, museums are not good at being ironical. They're not good at saying, like, you know, here's this piece of policy, but you should recognise that it's bad. They're much better at being declamatory, about saying, this is what Australia is like. So we just said, we think Australia is a diverse and plural thing. We think the reason for that, one of the reasons for that, is because of the incredible flow of people back and forth between Australia and overseas. So we're going to do a gallery representing that. I don't actually know what our mission statement is. Do you know what our mission statement is at the museum? The museum's mission statement.
Oh, here we are.
Oh, good.
Right, thank you.
What is it? I don't actually know.
It's on the table, but I haven't memorised it. Yeah, it's on the back of that.
Oh, there we are. Well, that's very general, isn't it? To promote an understanding of Australia's history and an awareness of future possibilities by developing, preserving and exhibiting a significant collection, taking a leadership role in research and scholarship, engaging and providing access for audiences nationally and internationally, and delivering innovative programs. There you go.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No, that's all right.
That's how
I'm sure I should have it memorised, you know, completely, but... Oh, no, thank you for a wonderful discussion. That was really great. I enjoyed that. So it was terrific. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.